Good afternoon. Today is January 14th, 2016. This is an interview with Malele Chikasa Anana. We are here at her home in Madison, Wisconsin. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Archives. Also in attendance is Michaela Sullivan Fowler from Ebeling Library, also on the UW-Madison campus. Okay, Malele, there was a... couple of questions I wanted to ask before we get back and asking a few more things about Umoja.
Okay.
And that's, I think you alluded to this when a couple other interviews, but the difference you found in being black in the North as opposed to being black in the South.
Well, there's a critical difference. In the South, people are pretty frank about their prejudice and open. And also about their outreach and extending a hand to you, talking with you. In the North, people had their prejudice, or at least they attempt to do so. And I particularly find it so in employment and the workplace. It's not a trusting place at all. And I don't know, people hire one black person, which is an awkward position to be in, having to represent a whole group of people and being called upon for advice of how to relate to black people, or only being interested in talking to black people when it's a matter of race or some prejudice act that they claim they don't understand. True friendships are hard to make up here in the North, beside the workplace thing and the retail experience. The retail experience is awful. People follow you around in the store constantly or ask for more information when you cash in a check than they would other people. Or tell you that something, when you bring a sale item to the counter, they claim it's not on sale. All kinds of chicanery you encounter, either in the workplace or in the retail experience or bank applications or mortgage. And so it's very hard to discern when and if a person is being authentic with you, because 90% of your experience is trickery and not being authentic. In the South, it's, at least when I was down there, it was more transparent.
Malele, there were a couple of stories that, unfortunately, in that first session, the memory card failed and we weren't able to get them. And so I was hoping, as you were sort of talking about the difference between being black in the North and being black in the South, that you might retell the story about your daughter in the Boston schools and the treatment that they wanted to give her, that you wouldn't let them do.
Right. I had a 7-year-old daughter at the time, and they called me to school one day and said that they wanted to inform me that she was going to be transferred to the retarded class. That's what they call special education back then. And I said, why? And they said, well, because the doctors examined her and found out that she was retarded. Well, we had a long discussion about it, and I was pushing back, and they told me two things. Number one, you're not an educator, so you can't make the proper assessment. And number two, the school doctor has already signed off on this, so she has to go in the retarded class. So, well, I wouldn't let her be placed there. And we had quite a heated discussion about it. And they finally gave me a choice, either put her in retarded or she can't come to this school anymore. So I took her home, and under the threat of, if you take her home, you'll be fined for being suspended, or whatever they call kids who are out of school.
Truant?
Truant, right. So I took her home, and the rest of that semester, I spent educating her myself and doing what I could to keep her, create a learning environment for her. Well, it turned out that the next year I was able to send her to a school district, be bused to a school district in a Jewish neighborhood where there were very bright kids and well-to-do parents who provided a lot of things for their kids. And she was placed with a old-fashioned school mom, and who said to me one day, "This is the brightest kid I've ever had." And this daughter, who was labeled retarded in second grade, ended up going to Stanford, being accepted there and going to Stanford. And her, the little girl who lived across from her, us, her mother didn't have the time or the energy to push back but Wendy was put in the retarded class, and I don't know where Wendy is today. So, and then on top of that, Kathy, that's my daughter's name, is a mom of six children, and she decided to homeschool all her kids in face of the prejudice and bad assessments they made in the California public schools. And of those six kids, four have gone to Berkeley and graduated with distinction. And one has now been accepted into 12 medical schools, from Johns Hopkins to University of Chicago, to Harvard, to Stanford, to Columbia. And another one is getting a PhD in organic chemistry at Caltech. And all of them have, you know, records of distinction.
Mm-hmm. The other, another story that I think might come from being black in the North and the South that we didn't get recorded that first time was a train trip in Florida right after a Supreme Court decision, and you decided that was the impetus to be able to sit up in the whites only car.
Right. Well, I was in college back then. It happened in Alabama, and it was 1954, and the Supreme Court, I heard on the radio, they come down with the decision that there would be no more segregation in the transportation systems, buses and trains and airplanes. And so I thought, oh, how neat. So on my way to school, to college, I took the train. I decided that, well, that's what the Supreme Court says, so that's the law. Back then, when you went to the train station, you showed your ticket, and then you were directed by the conductor to a coach car to sit on. And when he told me to go right or left instead of right, I knew you were sending me back to the segregated coach. That he is the conductor in this story. And so he was standing outside on the sidewalk, on the ground, and I went right instead of left. Well, after the train took off, he came back to me and said, oh, what are you doing here? You know you belong in the other coach. And I told him about the recent Supreme Court ruling. And he says, a bad name. And then he said, you know, we have our own rules down here. So I didn't move. And so, oh, 30 minutes later, he came back saying that the military occupied my seat and that they took priority and I would have to move. And again, I told him about the Supreme Court ruling, but it didn't do any good. So there was one empty seat on that coach next to a white woman. And I asked her if it was occupied, and she said no. And I sat there. And he was chagrined and outdone the whole trip, but there was nothing he could do. There were no more excuses.
Thank you. The next question I want to ask is, I think in the first interview you talked about where you grew up and the role of the school and the role of the church. I'm wondering, as you grew up and moved around, what role religion still played in your life?
Well, I'm not sure that religion played a big role in my life in growing up, though I did go to church fairly frequently. But there was what I would call the community investment in its children. I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. In Oklahoma City, I was born in Oklahoma City and grew up in Tulsa. And just recently, during this Christmas holiday, I found a scrapbook that I had put together in my ninth grade year at junior high school. It was a little raggedy kind of thing. But it reinforced how the community took care of us and how the men and women there exposed us to things. In that scrapbook, I had kept copies of every play that I went to that year, all the stage entertainment, all my, I don't know, Y Team this and Girl Reserve this, and the interscholastic competitions that we went to at the nearby Black University in Langston. They just took really good care of us. And I knew that, but the scrapbook brought it home to me. And it was what you call North Tulsa. That was the name of my community, to distinguish it from the White Tulsa. And we had our own little side of town. We knew that, as kids, we knew that when we went uptown, we were not supposed to go farther than 2nd Street. And, but in our community, the men and women built pharmacies and drugstores and doctor offices and 5 and 10 retail stores and car repair shops and supermarkets and credit unions, and so that we could be a self-contained community. And our dollars were recycled there. There was also a segregated school system. What I remember is that the white school board set aside a certain amount of funds for the Black schools and let the principals disburse the money. And so far as I'm concerned, I got a first-class education, caring teachers. The word dropout wasn't used back then. Everybody was expected to graduate from high school. In my scrapbook, there were even some letters from my being a cheerleader kind of thing. Well, it was really funny, and I recognized the names of my classmates, and one went on to become a state senator, Maxine Sissel. And it just, again, reinforced the good care they gave us, the high expectations they had of us, and the exposure that they gave us to become well-educated, smart kids. So that's what I remember about my childhood. I'm sure portions of my childhood were impoverished, but that doesn't come through in my memories, and that didn't come through in the scrapbook.
Okay. Malele, one more thing before we ask a couple of questions about emoji and more sort of present day stuff. Another great story you told that unfortunately didn't end up on the recording was the march in Washington.
Oh yes.
So I wonder if you wouldn't mind retelling that story, yeah, so we can make sure we get a recording.
I love to tell that story because I was living in Boston, Massachusetts at the time, in a community called Roxbury, which is equivalent to the Harlem of New York. And in that community, we walked a lot and we took buses. I was poor then. And I was walking down the street one night coming home from grocery shopping. And this guy stopped me and said, "Sister, would you like to go to the march?" He didn't say the march on Washington or explain, you know, what it was about. And I said, "Sure." Because everybody knew about that. Later I learned he was a community organizer. And that's how the March on Washington was assembled. They hired so many organizers to get people there in different communities. And I said, "Sure." He said, "Will you be right here on the corner of Humboldt?" I can't remember the other street. And something. It was in the neighborhood where Malcolm X had grown up to. Humboldt and something. "You be here tomorrow night on this corner at 11 o'clock because we're going to take off." I said, "Sure." Now, I went back to my apartment, and between that time and the next day, I made arrangements for my two kids to be taken care of and got excited about the march. And then I was there at 11 o'clock, and I boarded the bus with all strangers. I didn't know any of the people. I didn't have any MasterCard or Visa. I didn't have any money at all. I didn't have anything to eat. But they had arranged all of this. So we went down the coast, the East Coast, and we stopped at black churches along the way, where the mothers of the church had gotten up early in the morning at 4:30 or 5 to fix us breakfast of grits and eggs and biscuits. And they had cooked all of this stuff because there weren't supermarkets back then where you could buy homemade biscuits. And then they also gave us a box lunch so that when we got to Washington, we would have something to eat. Now, the ironic thing or interesting thing about the breakfast and the lunch and the meals they prepared for us is that we were going to Washington because we could not eat in cafes and cafeterias and the Cracker Barrels and the McDonald's along the way. So there again is an example of how the black community took care of itself and how we unified around an issue and we trusted one another. Because I would like to see if any of those people I rode on the bus with are still living today. I'd like to talk with them, but I don't even know who they were. And then when I got to Washington, we were entering the city, I cried. And much to my chagrin, because I was a big protester and I wasn't supposed to be crying, looking at the beauty of the buildings and the seat of my government, which wasn't fully recognizing my statue as a citizen. But nevertheless, I cried because it was a beautiful city. And then when we got to the March on Washington, what was his name? Randolph?
Oh, right.
Had organized it so well. We got off the bus and we were directed to go around the Lincoln Memorial. And there must have been 100 million buses there. All I can remember is these yellow buses parked on the streets. And we had no trouble finding our bus when it was time for us to come back home, about 6 or 7 o'clock. And everything was very well organized, put together. And we put our feet in the pool, the Lincoln Memorial pool, the water around there. And of course I heard Martin Luther King. But at the time, I didn't know that he was such a historical figure. I just knew that we were praising him for what he said.
Mm-hmm. Are you expecting somebody?
No. Who is that?
A printer.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah, he's bringing me something. My printer is bringing me.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was quite an experience.
So then afterward, you said you found your bus, and so did you just basically reverse the trip back?
Right.
Mm-hmm. What time, you remember about what time you got home?
No, I don't remember that. Thank you. Oh, good. No, I just remember getting on the bus, getting to Washington, and being there all day, having something to eat, and listening to Martin Luther King and being very inspired. I've got it, thanks. Mm-hmm.
So thank you for retelling that.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe just a couple of things before we wrap up today.
Oh, okay.
Let's talk about emoji now. We talked about it last time, but so as you took over emoji from a couple, I believe,
mm-hmm.
Once they stopped wanting to do it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So as you started to build it from what it was to what you wanted it to be,
mm-hmm.
who were some of the people or organizations that helped you with that?
Well, I don't think there was anybody who helped me. People were either not believing at it or thinking that it was some short-term project or something that didn't really mean anything. But from the very beginning, I had a idea that this was going to be something long lasting, because my whole mission was to tell the story of the Black achievement and the positive things in the Black community that the white media was missing. It's the white media focused on being an athlete as the pinnacle of success. And that was our role model for success. Or writing stories about crime and welfare and the less productive aspects of the Black experience. So I wanted to tell the other stories of people who had were successful in their jobs, teachers and accountants and whatever professions were represented. And I distinctly made the decision to stay away from any athletic success. I wasn't able to do that in every instance, because when the Badgers went to the Rose Bowl, I made the decision to put the Badgers on the front cover. I had an artist draw individual pictures of all the black Badgers. I wish I could find that copy.
That wasn't part of the show?
No, it wasn't. I made an exception for that. I made an exception for Ron Dane. And I made an exception for this ice skater who won, was in the Olympics. He happened to come here to Madison. Oh, I can't think of his name right now, but he's a well-known ice skater. And the way I met him is I was extremely exhausted, emotionally exhausted, 1 year from trying to, you know, gather stories and write them and get ads and everything. And I said, I'm going to take a recess and go to something where I won't see any black people. So I decided to go to the ice skating show at the Coliseum. And lo and behold, when I got there, there was this guy, what is his name, who was a major part of the show. He was just starting out. I'll think of his name.
Was he a speed skater?
You know who I'm talking about?
I do know who I'm talking about. I can see it.
He was like 18 or 19 then, and I didn't know he was going to become an Olympic medalist. But I thought, Lord, I want to get away from black people, and here now I got to do a story on him. I went backstage and talked to him and his mother, and I did a story on him. But he was one of maybe a half dozen sports people that I've done over the years.
Is his last name Davis?
Yes.
I think it's Sean or Shoney.
Shoney or something like that. Mm-hmm. Right. So I have some photographs of him when he was an aspiring Olympic medalist. Maybe he was 18 or 19 then. But anyway, back to my original purpose with Umoja. It looked like a little horsey church newsletter when I first started. But I kept writing and I kept digging up stories. And first I didn't write stories, I just wrote one long narrative. And somebody said to me one day, oh, I like Umoja, but I never get to the end. It's probably 7 or 8 pages. So I decided from that I would break the stories up into sections. So that's how I came up with the celebrate birthday page, and came up with community events and then professional achievements. And then somebody else said to me one day, I like Umoja, but it's not a real magazine. I said, oh, really? And so they said, yeah, but if you want me to, I'll sit with you and show you how it can become a magazine. And I took them up on the offer. And he was a journalism major, but he never could find a job here in Madison as a journalist. But he helped me redesign Umoja and rethink it into a magazine format. And about that time, I was knew I had to have a cover with people on it. But I didn't have the money for high professional photographs. So I got the bright idea of having a community artist prepare a cover for me on the Black experience. I didn't tell him what to do. And that's how I came up with Art on the Cover. Because I figured that their work would be professional enough that it could serve as a magazine cover. Now, 2 or 3 years into putting this art on the cover, which was a substitute for the high-quality photographs I should have had, I ran into a guy who was a very successful magazine publisher. He had about 3 or 4 magazines. And he said to me, you know, it's a nice idea to have art on the cover, but you'll never succeed because magazines always have people on the cover. And nobody's going to buy art as a magazine cover. And I said, oh, okay. And I took his remarks under consideration. And he said, excuse me, I will continue my art covers. And of course, that's been one of the most successful aspects of Umoja, is the art on the cover, as demonstrated by the exhibitions we've had all over the city of just the covers, along with the original artwork. I remember my very first foray into putting art on the cover was I had gone down to Chicago to the Disciple Museum. It's a very famous Black museum, and they always have a summer festival on their outdoor grounds down there. And I felt this note card that I was very impressed with. I went back to this man's booth 3 or 4 times, and I had taken the bus down there, and all the way back home I just kept thinking about the image that he had rendered. And so I didn't get good information from him, but somehow or another, 6 months later, I was able to find his name, I think, on the internet or something. And I tracked him down. He was in Canada, and I wrote him and asked him, could I use his work to be represented on my magazine cover? It took him about 6 months, but he answered me and said, yes, you can. And so that was one of my early images. And years later, maybe 6 or 7 years later, we were still in correspondence. And he said that I saved his life in the art world because he didn't think anybody was appreciating his work. And the reproduction on the cover enabled him to resume his work as an artist. He was basically an engineer. And you could tell that by the strong geometric images of the lines and the circles of his work.
Malaylee, I have one more thing I want to ask, and then I need to wrap up for the day. And,
okay.
I want to ask about a recurring theme, and I don't know when it started, but a recurring theme in the more recent magazines, and that's an issue about healthcare, an issue on healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you remember sort of what spawned that and then why you continue to do that.
Right. I was having difficulty getting ads month to month, and somebody suggested that I have editorial themes, and one of them should be health. So I did. Right away, I put that into practice, and so I have a whole issue devoted to just health topics. And a couple of times I've been able to have work-related, cover art related to that, but that's a difficult subject for an artist. And then from time to time I've had writers who were interested in submitting something along health lines. So that's how that came about. Health is just one of my editorial themes. I have finance, education, health, Martin Luther King, Black history. More than anything else, I probably have education and graduation. I salute all the Black graduates in Madison, from high school to college to PhDs. And I devote two full issues to that. One to college graduates, commending them, and another to the high school graduates. And I dig around every year for every name I can find out. Sometimes I get cooperation from the university, sometimes I don't. And the high school counselors are pretty good about providing me with all the names. I try to put the name of every Black graduate in Umoja every year. And then I do about 30 to 50 profiles.
Wow. Well, that's all the time I have for today.
Okay.
So thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
You are really...